This is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPM LP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from the members of the community. I'm Cheryl Jones.
And I'm Corinne Martin. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about protesters working to get weapons manufacturers out of Philadelphia, a group of young journalists working on a film about third spaces, and what's going to replace the Rocky statue at the base of the Art Museum steps.
But first, Pennsylvania schools will be required to teach students to read and write cursive starting on April 12th. This wouldn't be the first time. Schools were required to teach cursive up until 2010, when it was removed from the Pennsylvania Common Core Education Standards. Block by Block reporter Sophia Mattia spoke with several Philadelphia school teachers to find out how they feel about the new requirement.
Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro signed a bill earlier this year that will bring back cursive education to classrooms. The governor and lawmakers who support this measure say it's important because cursive improves students' cognitive ability, legal preparedness, and ability to read historical documents. Some of the teachers I spoke with say they see the value in cursive education, but some also question whether it's worth prioritizing cursive at a time when students are facing so many other challenges. Bridget Heaney is a second grade teacher for the Philadelphia Arts and Sciences Charter School. She says one concern that she has about teaching cursive is that she doesn't feel like she's had enough time to prepare.
I never learned cursive in public school, so teaching it would be quite a curveball for me because I would be teaching it and learning it at the same time. I do think I would be able to teach it, you know, letter by letter. Writing like a whole word might be a little bit hard, but I think it would be a challenge.
But Bridget says this isn't the first time the topic of cursive has come up in her classroom.
I've been teaching for 4 years now. My first year, I did have a student that was interested in it. So I didn't necessarily teach him, but I gave him different worksheets and different tools. And I hung up a cursive alphabet so he could refer to it because he was interested in it.
Bridget says she understands that many historical documents were written in cursive, but most have been digitized and converted to plain text, making them easy for anyone to access. And she's not sure it's worth prioritizing teaching a skill many students will rarely use when many are already struggling with the basics.
I am just a little concerned because many of our students currently can't write even just print. I hate to bring up COVID, but it pushed our students back academically, even those few years. And it's funny because these second graders weren't even in school at the time, but we are still seeing the effects of, you know, the developmental growth of these students. And so a lot of them are below grade level.
When students struggle with basic reading skills, it can affect their ability to learn all sorts of other things. So teachers like my cousin, Gina Santini, think it's important to focus on the basics first before expanding into things like cursive. Gina is a response intervention lead at the same school as Bridget. She specializes in helping kids focus on reading skills by working with them in small groups outside the classroom.
We tell our students and families all the time, if they don't know how to read, they won't succeed in math, they won't succeed in science or social studies, because that's the biggest problem. If you can't read a word problem, you cannot be successful in math. If you cannot read a sign, you might not even be able to sometimes drive. And we focus the most on reading to set them up for success. One of our biggest things that we often tell parents is that if your child cannot read by third grade, most likely that child will struggle the entire way through school.
Gina does know how to read and write in cursive. It's something she learned in Catholic school. But she thinks the new requirement is being rolled out too soon, since she has not heard details about how it will be incorporated into the already existing curriculum.
I remember from my Catholic schooling, we started cursive writing in second grade. That's major time that's going to be devoted in second and third grade to cursive. And for my kids, who are already 1 to 2 years behind, that's a lot of class time that is going to be devoted to cursive writing rather than them reading.
Gina's not totally opposed to teaching cursive. In fact, she used to teach it when she was a second grade teacher. But she says it would be challenging to start teaching again without more time to prepare. And another challenge is that the Philadelphia Charter School for Arts and Sciences gives every student an iPad to do their schoolwork on, starting in kindergarten. Gina says while digital literacy is important, this technology creates an additional problem when it comes to students' fine motor skill development.
There are so many times where our students do actually struggle with the fine motor skill of writing with a pencil because they are on iPad so much. So again, we try to go back to the fine motor skills of how to hold a pencil and printing. So if we're so focused on technology and then reading and then also printing regular letters, cursive is just not somewhere we wanted to devote our teaching time.
Some Pennsylvania schools never stopped teaching cursive, even when it wasn't required by the state. Mai Lee is an associate teacher at Little City Montessori in Philadelphia. She believes cursive education actually does help students develop fine motor skills, and also, it's a skill that they enjoy learning.
Even though you don't necessarily need it for adult life, it is really, really helpful with students' hand-eye coordination and their motor strength and their focus even. And the special thing about cursive is just how fun most kids find it. I very, very rarely ever teach a student who is like, oh, I really just don't want to do cursive. I don't find that exciting. I don't find that cool. They think it's so adult and special.
Montessori curriculum is about meeting children where they're at in terms of education, creating a specialized plan for each child. Like some of the other teachers I spoke with, Mai says that some of her students still struggle with skills like printing and reading at their grade level. But that struggle doesn't take away from their interest in cursive.
They're always excited by the cursive letters that don't look like their print counterparts. Like, I was teaching R recently, and they were so excited by that because they were like, whoa, cursive A looks the same as print A, but these look so different.
At Little City Montessori, the students use cursive writing books in the classroom, but also sandpaper letters and story cards, which activate the students' senses and help them remember how to write the letters.
Every single letter gets its own story because kids at this age are so tapped in to narrative learning. And every single letter has its own little name, and they all have their own little card that goes along with it and describes what motion is happening in the letter. And it makes me laugh because I'll be writing with the kids in cursive, or I'll be teaching them, and they'll be in the middle of writing like path. And if they get to the H and they forget how to do the H, I'll see them stop and they'll kind of say the story to themselves. They'll be like, Henry goes up and he comes back down. Then he goes up and over the mountain.
As the April 12th deadline approaches, teachers don't have a lot of time to figure out how to incorporate cursive education into their curriculum. But Philadelphia Charter School for Arts and Sciences teacher Gina Santini says she's hoping for the best.
For this year, I think everyone is just trying to survive the end of the year, put it into the curriculum so we could say we did it, not focus on it. And then I think next year we'll see how teachers use it.
This is Sophia Mattia for Block by Block.
Over the past few years, many Philadelphians have participated in direct action campaigns to protest, boycott, and otherwise hold accountable defense contractors and other businesses in the region that activists say are causing harm locally and globally. Block by Block reporter Dunya Ramadan spoke with one of the leaders of a campaign pressuring a Philly-based weapons manufacturer to leave the city.
Weapons manufacturer Dane Zimmerman has been headquartered at 15th and Spring Garden in Philadelphia. And for nearly a year, a group of protesters have been gathering outside the building every Tuesday morning. After Dane Zimmerman announced in February that the company will move to 1835 Market Street, protesters started showing up there, too.
There's a weapons manufacturer named Dane Zimmerman about to be headquartered in this building. Just letting people know, they make bombs and bullets for Israel, so we're just spreading the word.
That's one of the participants campaigning to get Dane Zimmerman out of Philadelphia. I'll be speaking to their peer, another participant in this campaign, but for their safety, we're going to call them Sam in this story, although that's not their real name. Sam says getting Dane Zimmerman out of Philadelphia is part of the fight for Palestinian liberation from Israeli occupation. The company makes many of the weapons the Israeli military has used in Palestine.
Dane Zimmerman is one of the largest weapons manufacturers in the world, and their headquarters is in our backyard in Philadelphia. Dane Zimmerman has a plethora of subsidiaries. They do staffing, they do government contracts, they do IT, they do private security, and it's all owned by the Yeo family. Hal Yeo, Mike Yeo, that family is worth billions.
Dane Zimmerman manufactured the very munitions used by the Israeli military to kill children like 6-year-old Palestinian Hind Rajab and other children in Gaza.
the rounds that they shot at Hind Rajab weighed more than she did, and they shot her 360 times.
Military-style weapons aren't only used in other countries. Military weapons and tactics developed in the U.S. are often used both overseas and at home. For example, in 1985, the Philadelphia Police Department, or PPD, dropped a military-style bomb on the residential home that housed the Black Revolutionary Organization, MOVE.
For most people, it's, you know, among the darkest days in Philadelphia's history, but I think people think of that as if it's a moment in the past rather than part of an ongoing struggle, an ongoing violence by the state, by PPD, that hasn't ceased in the slightest. It's only changed forms. And so you can't condemn the MOVE bombing in one breath without simultaneously condemning Dan Zimmerman's existence. If the arms that PPD uses to terrorize communities in Philadelphia, if they're manufactured by Dan Zimmerman, if they're manufactured by another arms manufacturer, it's all exactly the same system.
According to IMEU Policy Project, just in February of this year, the Israeli military used M16 rifles likely manufactured by another U.S. arms maker to kill Philadelphia-born and raised 19-year-old Palestinian-American Nasrallah Abu Siam in his family village in the occupied West Bank. This connection to violence abroad and at home here in Philadelphia is why protesters have been gathering outside of weapons manufacturers like Dan Zimmerman's current headquarters at 1500 Spring Garden, and now the building that company plans to move into on Market Street. Every Tuesday morning, rain or shine, hot or cold, Sam and other members of the community have been engaging in a series of noise demonstrations, rallies, and flyering sessions. The goal is to let people working in the building and surrounding areas know that a weapons manufacturer wants to be their new neighbor. And he's hoping that people working at Dan Zimmerman get the message too.
For the last 40-odd weeks, a lot of Philadelphians have gathered at 6:30 in the morning to tell me how much they hate my guts and how they understand who I am and what I do. Every Tuesday, they name me and a couple of my coworkers. And I can hear from where I am on the 30th floor or whatever, Dan Zimmerman, your hands are red, and that we can't hide, screamed at the top of their lungs. If you're working at Dan Zimmerman, if you are a higher up and you're the person signing these deals, or maybe you're an intern getting coffee for Harold Yo, you certainly understand what it is you're doing and what you have dedicated your life to. But I would imagine that your hope is that you think you can go get groceries or go on the subway or walk around your block and have people not know exactly what it is and believe that you can commit your life to genocide in silence. And so I think the noise demonstrations are a way for us as Philadelphians to express that, no, we know exactly what it is you do. And we're going to make you feel our rage. We are going to scream at you as you walk into work and tell you exactly what it is you do and exactly how Philadelphia feels about what you do. You won't be able to hide from your complicity ever again. If we get them evicted and they pick up and move to Jersey or New York or the other side of Pennsylvania, it's a win for us here in Philadelphia and that they aren't in our city. It's a win against Dan Zimmerman and that it slows them down, it costs them money, but beyond just getting them out of our city, the hope here is that we can unite Philadelphians in seeing Dan Zimmerman and all extensions of global empire as the enemy and understanding our power to make them bend to our will. And so I think that when Dan Zimmerman is evicted from Philadelphia, that is certainly not the end of this for us. We will only be satisfied when Dan Zimmerman ceases to exist.
Sam says there's been pushback against the demonstrations. Police have arrested some protesters in the past, but Sam says that's only strengthened participants' resolve. When the demonstrations started last year, Sam was one of only about 10 or so people participating. But now, as campaigners pass out flyers and interact with passerbys in front of Dan Zimmerman's new headquarters on Market Street, it looks like that number continues to grow.
Oh, there are a weapons manufacturer that's about to be headquartered in this building.
Oh, yeah, she told us about it last week. Yeah, I appreciate it.
And Sam hopes that more people continue to join.
I'll see you next Tuesday, hopefully, and the Tuesday after that. And the Tuesday after that, and the Tuesday after that, and the Tuesday after that, until DNZ gets the f*** out of Philadelphia.
For Philly Cam's Block by Block, I'm Dunya Ramadan.
Block by Block reporter Anaya Davis has been working with a set of young journalists in high school who are producing a short video documentary on the topic that's extremely relevant to their lives. Where are teens supposed to hang out these days? Anaya brings us the story.
Have you ever wondered, where is the nearest park I can sit in? Why can't I sit in my favorite cafe without buying something? And why does it seem like my favorite mall is shutting down? Having a space to exist that isn't your work or home, called a third space, has been a huge talking point amongst teenagers and young adults. WHYY young journalists Joe Ferranda, Amelia Kandub, and Nora Dorn are tackling this topic in their piece, The Death of the Third Space. The film will focus on the restrictions placed on teenagers in social spaces and the lack of third spaces. Their main focus? The mall. As their mentor, I've seen the teenagers interview market strategist Ryan Wall in Philadelphia, whose Drexel master's thesis explored third spaces and loneliness. They even traveled to Brooklyn recently to interview author Dr. Alexandra Lang about her book, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Joe asked Dr. Lang about how their relationship between malls and young people have changed over the years.
Malls were this place historically where teens were allowed, and then they weren't. I'm curious, like, why that came about, like, when that decision was made that they are now dangerous and, like, antithetical to, like, adult shoppers and their business.
The first parental escort policies started in the 1990s. That was this time of peak mall. That was this time where there were a lot of malls in pop culture. So I think it was really just the volume of teenagers and the volume of teenagers at the mall at that time that spooked many mall owners and did indeed create some dangerous incidents. Like, I'm not saying that teens at malls are never a problem.
There were positive notes from the interview that the students picked up on. Nora reflects on some facts she learned from that same discussion.
Dr. Lang talked about the interesting 8 versus 80 rule, where you should be designing third spaces for people who are both 8 and 80 years old. And that kind of thought process that goes into designing these spaces, I think, is really interesting.
That rule means that if a space works for 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds, that it will work for everyone. Amelia also had a few facts they learned from talking to the author.
I hadn't realized that malls came up in the 50s, like post-war, and sort of capitalized on this new teen demographic that was emerging. And that was meant to be sort of a villa inside. Like, I just thought that the progression of the history was cool. Also, malls usually have, like, 2 anchor stores and a bunch of other stores, but the fact that they have 2 main stores was something I hadn't noticed before.
Facts like these were important for the group to understand, since they want their film to combat the ever-growing opposition to having teenagers in social spaces outside of their homes and schools. Amelia says they've experienced this firsthand, but didn't understand just how important these spaces were to her until she explored this topic with her group.
I sort of hadn't considered how important third spaces are and what role they play in my life. I mean, I hang out with friends in different places, but on weekends, you know, my friends and I will struggle to figure out where to go. And I now have a better idea of, like, what that problem is and ways to fix it.
These solutions included public parks, libraries, and even outdoor spaces that are teenager-friendly. The group is creating this project for Youth Set the Stage, a collaboration of 6 local organizations dedicated to amplifying youth voices through media and art. With their showcase approaching, they reflect on what they want their audience to take from their film. Nora thinks about isolation.
Third spaces are so important, and we should be investing more time and energy into them, especially for teenagers and young people, and stop all these restrictions on where teens can or can't go, because it's making everything feel very isolated.
While Amelia thinks about independence.
We have a habit of overlooking third spaces and just hanging out in these everyday interactions that they're actually quite important. And also the value of teens and having that independence, especially now with like the internet and AI, and having that space to interact with fellow teens and make mistakes and, you know, have awkward social interactions, but still, like, with every interaction you learn something, and creating that space for it is important.
The journalists are heading into their final recording process using their reflections to create their own script. They hope to bring the audience new insight into third spaces, and maybe that there isn't death, but the space to birth new third spaces. For Block by Block, I'm Anaya Davis.
Many tourists who visit the Philadelphia Museum of Art every year run up the iconic steps in front of the museum and raise their arms in the air like Rocky when they reach the top. And for many years, a statue of Rocky has stood at the base of those steps. But soon, visitors will see a different statue there instead. One that shows the person some say is the real Rocky Balboa, heavyweight champion and Philadelphia legend, Smokin' Joe Frazier. Block by Block reporter Abby Cruz brings us the story.
Known for his strength, powerful left hook, and pressure fighting style, Joe Frazier was an Olympic gold medalist, heavyweight champion, and was the first boxer to defeat boxing legend Muhammad Ali, making history in the boxing world. Earlier this year, the Philadelphia Art Commission approved the proposal to move the statue of former heavyweight champion Smokin' Joe Frazier from its current location down South Philly to the bottom of the steps at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, home to the Rocky statue currently there. I recently caught up with Valerie Gay to find out more about why the statue is moving. She's chief cultural officer for the City of Philadelphia and executive director of Creative Philadelphia, which is the city's office of arts and culture. Gay says replacing the Rocky statue with one of Joe Frazier makes sense because it would shine a light on the real boxer who was one of the inspirations for the fictional Rocky.
Joe Frazier was the one that hit the meat in the slaughterhouse. Joe Frazier was the one that ran the steps to the art museum. It's an iconic thing. The boxers are the ones that run the parkway. It's just a natural thing that is so Philly, and people come from all over the world to visit the Rocky statue, which is amazing, and we want them to. And we can say that we are connected, our humanity is connected in that story around grit and resilience, being the underdog. But the first one, the real one, is the guy who's now going to be at the base of the steps.
The city recently approved a plan to permanently keep one statue of Rocky at the top of the art museum steps. Meanwhile, the Rocky statue that stood at the bottom of the steps for years was recently moved inside the museum for an exhibit. Gay says the move created an opportunity.
Simultaneously, the Frazier family, you know, some other folks were saying, when is Joe Frazier going to get his turn with so much attention on Rocky? And that's when we really started working on it. So last August, September is when we really started working on it. And so there were a bunch of steps in place or that had to go in sequential order. But the mechanism of how it happened is that Marguerite presented to the Art Commission.
The Philadelphia Art Commission is the group that approves any public art that's on city property.
That's Marguerite Anglin, the public art director with Creative Philadelphia, who has been alongside Valerie, assisting with the project and statue relocation.
Marguerite, you had a quote that I read. You said, as we celebrate our 250th, visitors will come here seeking authentic stories about Philadelphia. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
There's over 4 million visitors that come to those steps. Many of them are, as Val referenced, looking for Rocky, and they don't know the story of Joe Frazier. Joe Frazier is a Philadelphian. You know, he wasn't born here. He was born in South Carolina, but he came here as a youth, and he was able to overcome so many obstacles, you know, disabilities, his, you know, left arm, issues with his eyesight, his height and his stature. And so he's the quintessential underdog. And so that grit of Philadelphia, that determination, that fighting spirit that his daughter loves to say, that Philadelphia fighting spirit. I mean, that's the authentic story that people are going to be greeted with when they come to the base of the steps. And, you know, before they even make that trek up to the Rocky statue, they're going to be grounded in that Philadelphia realness of this real life champion who inspired Rocky. And so we're excited for visitors to come all over the world. I mean, they come from, you name it, to see Rocky, and they're going to learn about the backstory, the origin story for the Rocky movie.
Now boxing fans from all over can enjoy not only what they see in movies, but truly get the best of Philadelphia with both icons together, showing brotherly love at its core.
How important is Joe Frazier to the city of Philadelphia? What does he mean to people that are born and raised here, that are boxing fans, that are Philadelphians?
He may not have been born here, but he is one of us. He represents us. How he overcomes the challenges that other people would have seen as a challenge. He is so inspirational to us because we all have something that we have to overcome. The inspiration is whatever it is that you have, you're like, I don't like this about myself. This is keeping me back. That thing may be your superpower because that's what became his superpower. So that left hook that we know, we learned about that during the Art Commission hearing. His daughter, Judge Jackie Frazier, lied, was speaking and saying my dad, he had a disability because they were poor. So, let's count that. Four. Let's count that. And black. Right? You count all these things coming from the Jim Crow South. You count all these things. There is no reason in the world. Someone would probably look at him as a child and say that this man, 50, 60, 70 years later, would be the one who people would be cheering. And yet, he is all of us. So there is a Joe Frazier, I think, in all of us. The opportunity for us to look at our challenges, to look at the best in the world and say, this is what I have. But it's not just kind of just walking up and I think I can do it. No, putting in the hard work, being diligent, being willing to outwork everyone, not taking the fact that you don't have resources available to you. You use what you had. Oh, you don't have a punching bag? I got a side of beef. Guess what? That's going to make me stronger, you know? And so, you don't have a gym? Guess what? I got these streets and I got these steps. And so that is indicative of the true Philly grit. And not all of us have to scrape and overcome, but we all have to scrape and overcome something in our lives. And he represents that just like Rocky represents it in the mythical side of things.
Until next time, reporting for Block by Block, Abby Cruz.
Block by Block is produced by Amadi Braxton, Abby Cruz, Anaya Davis, Achman, Hasuna, Charlie Klein, Sophia Mattia, Milan Parker, Dunya Ramadan, Tafari Robertson, and us,
Corinne Martin,
and Cheryl Jones. Anaya Davis is our board operator tonight.
Brad Linder is radio news managing editor for WPPM. Peita Liu is the radio operations manager. And Allison Durham is WPPM's radio program manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on PhillyCam SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.